Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Amy Eddings, in for Brian Lehrer here on WNYC. Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, Bahrain, and now Morocco? On July 1st, Moroccans voted in sweeping constitutional changes, acknowledged at the same time as, at best, small steps toward reform, and at worst, as slight concessions. The 98% approval rating for the national referendum has brought allegations of corruption and fraud from those who say the vote was rigged and that the reforms did not go far enough to curb the king's authority. In the newly approved constitutional changes, the king maintains nearly absolute political power and unquestioned control over the military and will select a prime minister from the party that wins the most seats in parliament. Now, that's a change. Previously, the king could select anyone to be prime minister, regardless of their political affiliations. The changes have been hailed as a model in the Arab world by analysts and even by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who visited the country in March.
Morocco is well positioned to lead in this area because it is on the road to achieving democratic change. His Majesty King Mohammed VI's government has consistently allowed its citizens to express themselves openly and peacefully, and it has been frank and forthcoming about the challenges ahead.
Joining me now to discuss the Moroccan Spring is Laila Lalami, an author and associate professor of creative writing at the University of California at Riverside, who has written opinion pieces on Morocco for The Nation, Newsweek, and Foreign Policy magazine. Her most recent book is the novel Secret Sun. Welcome, Laila, to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You are Moroccan, have spent much of your life there, most recently living there in 2007. On Monday, The Times published a contributed op-ed piece entitled All Hail the Democratic King, praising the constitutional referendums. What did you think of the piece?
I thought it was very pro-king. I mean, from the title on down, I thought that it described the events in ways that seemed to me optimistic, to say the least.
What do you make of the 98% approval rating for the constitutional changes?
Well, I have to tell you, it did take me by surprise. I expected, as I think many Moroccans expected, the referendum to pass. There was no question from the get-go that it would pass. I expected, statistics around maybe 80 or 90%, but definitely not 98.5%, which is what the official numbers of the Ministry of Interior gave. And I think that really kind of affected the credibility of the referendum, particularly because there were allegations of fraud and irregularities. For example, people would go to vote and their names would, and they didn't need to show a voter card as required by Moroccan law. So there were allegations like that plagued the vote.
You heard the clip we played of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. You've already mentioned what you think of the op-ed piece. Despite thinking that the reforms don't go far enough, do you think that there's any truth to what Secretary of State Clinton had to say, that they are steps in the right direction? The Moroccan protests have been far more peaceful than those elsewhere. Reports from Morocco are that the referendums seem to have satisfied at least some of the demonstrators there.
I mean, I think it's noteworthy that the comments that Secretary Clinton made were made in March, and this was in a way a different context than the one that we're in now. At the time, the King of Morocco had just given a speech. He gave a speech on March 9 to announce these reforms that have taken place. And so that happened only 17 days after the February 20 movement, which is the movement that has been demanding change, came out into the streets. And so at the time, it did seem like a major concession that, only 17 days after people take to the streets, the king announces that there's going to be constitutional reform. But I think what has happened in between that moment and now is that there's been a change in the regional context, and you mentioned this in your introduction when you were talking about, for example, Bahrain, where the uprising was crushed by Hamid bin Khalifa, or if you look at Syria, where Bashar al-Assad has been slaughtering his own people, or if you look at Libya, where there's foreign intervention. So all the regional context is such that in several places, the revolutions have turned bloody. And in addition to that, there was a bomb that exploded in Marrakesh at the very popular tourist cafe called the Cafe Argana. So I think that this context has created fears of chaos and fears of the revolution, of even the uprising in Morocco turning bloody. So that's one part of the context. The other part is that the Moroccan government has also engaged in its own ways in forms of repression. It's just that these forms of repression have been a little bit more subtle than what we have seen in the region. So, for example, there have been threats, both physical and verbal, against the activists of the February 20 movement. There have been attempts at press censorship. There have been, and at the same time, the government also raised the pay of the riot police. They raised yesterday, they announced that they were raising the pay of the imams. I mean, they've done a number of strategies to try and take the wind out of the sails of the February 20 movement. And so that context is what, in the end, led to the fact that, in spite of all the promises, the reforms that were actually delivered in the Constitution were smaller than what people might have expected them to be.
Moroccans, what do you think of the referendum and the constitutional changes? Have you been watching the rest of the Arab Spring unfold with an eye toward your native country? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Our lines are open for listeners with ties to Morocco. As always, there's also our comments page, WNYC.org. Lila, you have noted in your writing that Moroccans have not said they want to overthrow the king, as protesters in other countries have said about their own rulers. Why not?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons for that, but perhaps the most important is that if they had called for that, if, say, for example, the February 20 movement had come out into the streets and said that this is what they want, they would have gotten no support. The king, and this is, you know, whatever you think about him, the king does remain a popular figure in Morocco. And part of the reason for that is that he has managed over the last 11 years of his reign to distance himself from the ruling elite, what is referred to as the Makhzen. So if you look at, for example, the most important steps of progress in Morocco, if you look at the family law reforms, for example, or if you look at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which investigated abuses during the 1980s, police abuses during the 1980s, those two big steps were steps that were initiated by the king. So the king, in a way, managed to present himself as a force for change, for positive change, by taking steps like that. He presented that image to Moroccans, while at the same time, the ministers are seen as being very corrupt, are seen as being very inefficient. So he gets the credit for the change, and the government gets the blame for anything that goes wrong, in spite of the fact that he's the one who appoints the government and that the government is accountable to him. So I think that that's why, strategically speaking, it would have made no sense for the February 20 movement to come out and say, we want to overthrow the king, because they wouldn't have gotten support. Instead, what they have asked for is for a parliamentary monarchy, for modeled on Britain or on Spain, where the king reigns but does not govern. I should also say that this kind of demand is the kind of demand we haven't even talked about openly in Morocco for decades. So this is one of the welcome changes that the February 20 movement has brought to the country, which is that it really has opened up the discussion and has enabled Moroccans to really discuss these issues more openly.
I'm speaking with Lila Lalami, who has been writing about unrest in Morocco for The Nation, Foreign Policy Magazine, and Newsweek. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Hassan from Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Hi.
Hi there. You have a question or comment for Laila Lalani?
Yes, I have a comment as well as a question. The comment is that the comment about the new constitution, it's really, my belief is that it's a continuation of the 1962 constitution, which is concentrates 99% of the power on the king. And really, the maneuvers that happened in 96 of the new constitution, it just really emptied all the political parties of their role. And you're talking about just paving a road in a rural area. The king has to be getting involved. So I was there like 4 years ago. The project cost like $1 million, and the movement of the protocol of the king when he came in, it was like $10 million. So he emptied all the political parties out of the really what they're supposed to do, because we don't have no political parties. We have about 36 political parties, and
Hassan,
none of them really...
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you because your line is degrading and it's difficult to understand your point, but we did get that you think it's just a continuation of old forms. Laila Lalami, how true is that? I'm looking at some of the key reforms as reported by the BBC, the one that I mentioned before. The king will select a prime minister from the party that wins the most seats in parliament. A reference to the king as sacred in the constitution will be removed, though he will remain inviolable. I don't know, is that changing? Just changing deck chairs on the patio?
Maybe you can explain the difference between sacred and inviolable. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
But, I mean, I think that one of the important changes, however, is, for example, the recognition of the Amazigh, the language of the Amazigh people as an official language of Morocco. This is something that, for example, human rights activists and Berber activists had been asking for a long time, and the fact that it was included in the constitution is definitely a big step forward. The problem, however, is that the wording of it is that it talks about the Amazigh language. Now, my understanding is that Amazigh is a term that refers to the people. The language actually has three variants, and it's unclear which one of these is the official, or if all three are official, and what it means to be an official language of Morocco. Let's say you are a farmer in a small town in the Rif Mountains, and you have to appear in court. Does that mean that you are entitled to have a court interpreter so that you can speak your native language, the Tamazight, for example, or Terifit in this case, and that you would be entitled to that because that is an official language of Morocco? Does it mean that street signs are going to be in other languages? It really is unclear. You know, having something like that in the Constitution is going to require interpretation. And it seemed to me that the language that was used was you know, somewhat ambiguous. So that's one thing that they included in the Constitution. But some of the other changes, for example, that give the Prime Minister a little bit more power seem very positive. But at the end of the day, the King can dissolve Parliament completely at will. He retains control of the military completely, as well as religious affairs. And like you said, you know, he's no longer sacred, but he's inviolable.
Right.
So
whatever,
you know,
that means.
These are not,
right.
So these are not major, major changes, you know.
We will have to leave it there. My guest has been Laila Lalami, Associate Professor of Creative Writing at the University of California at Riverside. She's been writing opinion pieces about the changes in Morocco for The Nation, Newsweek, and Foreign Policy magazine. Her most recent book is the novel Secret Son. Thank you, Laila, for bringing us up to date on what's going on in Morocco. And, of course, the conversation continues on the Brian Lehrer Show page at WNYC.org. Thanks, Laila. I'm Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, we will hear some offbeat advice for city living.